Is that when it can? Today is July the 4th, 1977, and I'm talking with Admiral Finchnoise, and we're going to continue talking about training in the RCN during the 1930s. Admiral Finchnoise, you wanted to say something about venture?
Yes, I hadn't mentioned the venture. In 1937, our first full-time training ship was commissioned, and that was a replica hull-wise of the famous Blue Nose, which was the undefeated champion of the fishing fleets of North America. This fine vessel was built by the Mategan Shipbuilding Company in Mategan County, Nova Scotia. And unfortunately, I think I must say it, due to the lack of appreciation of sail headquarters, they decided to give her three masts instead of Blue Nose's two on the false assumption that it would make for less work because the sails would be smaller. Actually, with three masts and a schooner of that size, it made for more work. And did a great deal to make her much slower and more ungainly than her this great ship after which she was patterned. Venture was designed for ordinary seamen's initial seagoing training, and she carried a complement of 40 men, including 24 ordinary seamen under training. She was an auxiliary schooner in that she had a Petter diesel 120 horsepower engine, which gave her a speed of 7 knots under power alone. Her radius of action was 1,000 miles, and she carried water and provisions for 30 days. Her sail area was not to be sneezed at, as she carried 12,000 square feet of canvas. I was fortunate enough to in Halifax at the time she commissioned and took part in her sailing trials before we finally took her over. She had a bad start in that when she arrived under the temporary command of Lieutenant Commander Adams from Mategan, she had a sheriff's notice on her nailed to her mainmast. This was nothing to do with the RCN, but rather some litigation which had been started against the Mategan Shipbuilding Company. That was soon removed, and Lieutenant Commander Pressey, my old CO in the Champlain, was her first captain. She cruised right up until the war extensively in much the same areas that the rest of us did, that is in the West Indies in the winter and around the Canadian coast during the summer. She trained a lot of very fine seamen in those 2 years remaining before the war, and she finished her days in the service as the guardship at the entrance to Bedford Basin, as there was no crew for her, and she was paid off as soon as the war began. She was a beautiful ship, as only a replica of the Blue Nose could be. There are one or two other things that I think I should mention of this era under discussion. And one is how people were born on the books of a ship. In those days, one had to be born on a ship's book, and even though your ship was a stone frigate, as we call it. That is, it had ceased to be a normal man of war, and all kinds of subterfuges were used to ensure that some kind of floating vessel carried the name of the ship, such as Stadacona or Naden in the case of the barracks on the east and west coast. Your record, therefore, carried you right throughout your career, borne on some book, on some ship's book, and this was used for payment, etc. Incidentally, in those days, the old custom of paying the hands in cash was still carried out at a table on payday, and men below the rank of petty officer received their pay on their cap, which was placed on the table. And they pay it, the money itself was placed on the cap. We had done this when we were cadets in HMS Erebus. Another interesting feature of naval life in those days was the meal hours, which, as you will see, will have changed somewhat. Men went to breakfast at 7 o'clock, but don't forget, by that time they had all carried out at least 1 hour's work, usually scrubbing and washing down the upper deck and squaring off the ship for the day's work to start at 8 o'clock. Men went to dinner, and at that time the rum or grog was issued. But there was a third meal, which has now been lost in changing conditions, and that is tea, which was normally piped at 16:30. This consisted of tea, jam, toaster bread, and that type of snack meal. Because the final meal of the day's supper was not piped until 6:30 or sometimes 6 o'clock. And this, of course, with changing conditions, particularly in Canada, has gone slowly back. And I think now that if given the opportunity, the average sailor would probably like to have his last meal of the day about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if he could, particularly in harbor. Messing was entirely different from the modern excellent food which is now produced in HMC ships. The broadside messing was still in vogue, and this consisted of cooks of messes, which were detailed off by the leading hand of each mess, preparing vegetables, etc., not the meat, but vegetables, and taking it to the cooks for the cooking, and then appearing at meal hour to pick up the food for their particular mess. The reason it was called broadside messing was, in those days, men slung in hammocks in the mess decks, but their tables were athwartships and could be either slung up to the ceiling of the mess deck or stowed in some particular position depending on the ship. And this went right back to the days when the guns in old men of war were actually in the mess decks, and they cleared away for action.
Did the officers eat on roughly the same schedule?
In destroyers in the 30s, there was a separate officers fed separately, naturally, and but they also paid for a great deal of their food themselves. There was a small messing allowance, and any extras one had, one paid for out of your own pocket. There was no general messing of any kind in those days. It was strictly, those were the two types, broadside messing for the men. Of course, they didn't pay for their, men naturally didn't pay for their meals, but officers, other than this small allowance, which was allowed for each person in the ship, the rest of it was done. And the cooking and the serving of meals was done in the wardroom.
In other words,
not in a small destroyer like Champlain. It was done in her in the same place, but done at the. But officers fed at slightly different times, particularly only at the dinner and in harbor. Particularly, dinner was normally at 8 o'clock or 7:30 at night, but usually about 8 o'clock. So you couldn't have the same meal if you wanted to, because the men had already fed.
What I meant was you meant mess allowance. I'm not sure how that.
Well, it was just the mess allowance was a small allowance to allow people to feed in case you. It was in lieu. The mess allowance was paid in lieu of actual food and was credited against the officer.
So all. So in effect, you were all the food that an officer consumed, he was paying for.
No, because you had an allowance.
Yes, but he paid for it out of that allowance.
Oh yeah. Right. I mean, that was just sure. But there were, every ship had an extra amount of money was paid by the wardroom decided that was the amount of money that you had on your mess bill at the end of the month over and above any allowance, which of course you never saw anyway. That was discredited on the bookkeeping of the ship in the victualling department.
Were you aware of any reason for that? Because it's not done nowadays.
Well, the reason was the general messing hadn't come in, and it had been, in the old days, captains and officers ran their own messes. They were, as far as feeding, they had their own staff, and the staff looked after them. As captain of Quebec in 1950, I ran my own mess with my small complement aft, and again, I was given allowances for the normal sort of staple foods, and the remainder, if I wanted to have a smart dinner party or something, I paid the difference.
How frequently would one attend mess dinners and similar functions?
Oh, well, in those days, when you were cruising properly in harbor, you sat down in mess undress to dinner every night, including Saturday, except on Sunday, and that was usually supper, and the only difference there, instead of getting into mess undress, you just wore a bow tie in your ordinary number 5 uniform, which is the normal uniform worn by an officer. There's no question it was every night of the week except Sunday.
Is that right?
That's not quite that's answering not your a question dinner, because right? No, the mess dinner usually on Thursday nights in practically all ships.
Once a week they had
once a week
mess.
And that would give people an opportunity, particularly when you had ships and company, to ask friends to dine with you, and that was a formal dinner. And another thing, in the small destroyers, in the Champlain in which I served, they were so small that the captain still dined in the wardroom. Now that changed with the advent of the Skeena and the bigger destroyers, of which she was one of the early examples. And from then on, the captain ceased to be a member of the wardroom, and he dined in his own cabin. There was his quarters were that much bigger that they gave him a dining and sitting room completely separate from his sleeping accommodation, and in that case, he's as in bigger ships, he ran his own mess, and He became an honorary member of the wardroom, but he ceased to be a member of the wardroom itself. That was quite a change for the Canadian Navy, because we never had a ship big enough before that that he could dine anywhere else. Of course, at sea, he'd be usually dine at, and he'd usually have his meals out near the bridge where he had a sea cabin anyway.
What, during the 30s, what sort of things were done at mess dinners?
Oh, mess dinners were lots of fun. It was a formal, very pleasant meal. There were various kind of games after dinner, but until his or her Majesty's health had been drunk, the president of the mess, aided by a vice president, ensured that there were no infractions of the rules, which had grown probably over the last 1,000 years in the Navy, one type or another, were broken. If you saw fit to break the rules, which you knew anyway, then there was a varying punishments meted out by either the president or the vice president. One fun one we had when we were midshipmen in the doing our destroyer time, our captain always seemed to have to leave the table in the middle of dinner, and he invariably forgot to ask permission to leave the table, as he was the president anyway, whereupon the chief, with a broad grin on his face, would leave his chair and sit in the captain's place, and when the captain returned a few minutes later, he would find him around the port, which incidentally was quite a cost. There were only 7 officers, including the 2 midshipmen anyway. As I say, the entertainment after depended on the ship and the people concerned. We were never big enough to have any large-scale entertainments in destroyers, but quite often bridge or poker or games of chance of some kind, if they felt like it, or there were many good old-fashioned naval games, such as priests of the parish and that type of thing, that were played, and usually caused a lot of fun for the people concerned.
Well, what sort of game was that?
Oh dear, I can't go in. That's a long one. If I told you the rules, it was actually a game of it's a sort of a verbal drill game, which. A mistake in this had been played, I think, by the French gunrooms way back in the Napoleonic War era, or even earlier, and had been adopted by the Royal Navy years ago. Again, being all youngsters, the punishment for making a mistake in a very fast, quick verbal dialogue between people, the mistake was usually rewarded by what they used to call two flips on the good flips on the bundoon, or whatever it happened to be, and the bundoon, of course, was your bottom, usually with a rolled-up illustrated London News, so it really didn't hurt you very much. There were all kinds of customs which are still, I hope, being observed, such as in the gunroom when the older midshipmen wanted to tell a story which wasn't seemly for the younger ones, although only about 6 months younger. The president of the mess would say the junior midshipman fork in the beam. Well, in a steel ship, you couldn't put a fork in the beam as you could when this old custom originated, but all that meant to you was put your fingers in your ears and don't listen until such time as the president tells you you can again. I think most of these things were designed to keep people on their toes, and as well as, and again, nobody was ever hurt in that type of thing. There are many others, but I think those are sort of examples. 1836. The old Champlain, particularly, as she'd done her most of her life on the East Coast, and the Vancouver, were considered to be getting too old, and the Admiralty placed at our disposal four of the ex-Crescent class, which were a slight peculiarity in the shipbuilding program of the Royal Navy in those days, because due to financial stringency, only four of them had been laid down. Normally, a destroyer flotilla consisted of eight destroyers and one leader. And the leader was a similar type of ship, sometimes slightly larger and often carrying an extra gun. And the reason she was larger was that she was the ship that led the flotilla and had to have extra accommodation for Captain D and his staff. These four ex-Crescent class destroyers were slightly more modern than the Skeena and Saguenay, but had not been strengthened for ice as the two we built ourselves. However, they were very fine ships and were renamed after rivers: Fraser, Saint Laurent, Ottawa, and Restigouche. Another type of ship which we had in our Navy at that time were old 1918 ex-trawler minesweepers, and were used for such things as fishery patrol. Armentières was a good example, and on the West Coast, Heapball and Armentières on the West Coast, and Yeeps and Vestubert on the East Coast. They had carried one 3-inch gun and were 350 tons displacement. Just before the war broke out, we had laid down in 1938 four new minesweepers, which were built in Canada, and they were Comox, Fundy, Gaspee, and Nootka. Better stop that for a second. In those years, the RCN, like any other Navy or service, had its share of characters. And two in particular, as I served on the same coast as them for many years, always come to mind. One was able seaman Pal Clark, probably one of the best heavyweight boxers in any Navy if he had only stayed in training. And after a run ashore, when he was serving in the Venture, was to come back and wrestle with a brown bear that Lieutenant Commander Pressey had acquired somewhere in Nova Scotia, and this was the ship's pet. That was always quite a sight, because as the bear grew bigger, he also grew stronger, and the heavyweight champion of the Navy had a tougher run in with him each time he fought him. For some extraordinary reason, the bear, to my knowledge, never bit or scratched Pal all the time this extraordinary party went on. Another old AB who had originally served in the RN, as in those days quite a few still had, was Daisy Beale. And Daisy was a real character. He should have had three good conduct badges years ago, but he always seemed to be losing them. And one thing that Daisy never got to do was he'd save up his money, never go into party, ever went ashore, until the day when he was supposed to go back to the UK to see his old mother. And first lieutenants and captains had tried for years to get Daisy Veal back to England to see his mother. But he never made it until Saguenay was in New York at the time of the World's Fair. No, in 1936, I'm sorry. And then Lieutenant Commander Mingy, the first lieutenant, decided that he would make sure that this happened. He had the ticket bought, and the shore patrol took Daisy down to the Queen Mary just before she sailed, and they stayed there at the gangway until the ship sailed for England, so he finally got back. Otherwise, he used to go ashore, good faith, get drunk, stay ashore for a couple of days, to which he was entitled, and leave, and then turn up, quite repentant, back to the old ship, which he knew much better than anywhere else. He was a real character, and as far as doing his job, usually his able seaman in charge of the mess deck did a very good one. Okay.
When the war broke out, you were in headquarters by then, or
I just was going to headquarters at that time. Yeah, and well, it was an experience. Naturally, wherever you were, the fleet was mobilized at that time. The four Fraser class destroyers were on the West Coast, as in those days, the West Coast was considered the weak side of Canada. I presume because Japan was the threat, if any. And about two-thirds of the complement of the RCN were stationed on the West Coast. In other words, it was much the biggest.
The East Coast, you mean?
No, West Coast. On the West Coast. Did I say East? Sorry.
No,
West Coast, yeah. Before Canada formally declared war, we, of course, had been brought to war notice, and those four destroyers were steaming at practically full speed for the East Coast to join up with Saguenay and Skeena, which were already starting to convoy ships out of Halifax. They were at war complement as soon as each of them came into harbor, and quite ready to take on anything that they'd met right from before, as I say, before Canada actually declared war.
Were they put immediately to convoy work, or?
Yeah, Saguenay and Skeena started convoying right away because the convoy system had already been worked out, and ships were steaming for ports such as Halifax in order to report in order that the convoys could be started. They had decided that the convoy system was better than, except for very fast ships, so traveling by themselves, and that, of course, was proved as the war went on. It's interesting, I've used the figures here because they're right in front of me, and I think they're pretty close. We're in the 1939 Jane's fighting ships, so the complement of our Navy. I say it's as close as... there are 150 officers in the RCN and 1,822 men. Don't forget, that included two very large, relatively large terms of the special entry cadets, of which I'm one. The last, the 39 and, well, it was the 38 and 39, who were still cadets and midshipmen. And they were all serving, of course, in the RN. They weren't back at home. They gave the RCNR complement as 70 and 430, and the RCNBR is 138 officers and 1,678 men. So you can see when we started out the war with including reserves under 4,000 people. And when one thinks at the end of the war we were approximately 110,000, there was a great increase in the numbers of people serving in blue uniforms.
Yeah.
I spent 2.5 years at headquarters during a very formative time, naturally. And when the war broke out, I think I'm right in saying there were 8 or 9 officers in the whole of headquarters. But that soon expanded with people coming from all walks of life and from reserves and from civilian things to help out. And naturally, with the tremendous growth of the Navy in both men and in material, this had to be. One of the hardest things to do, of course, at the beginning was to try and find jobs for the many people who immediately volunteered for the Navy. The great shipbuilding program, although on paper, at heart, didn't really get started right at the beginning of the war, because there were very few shipbuilding facilities in Canada to carry it out. And so I remember with many of my friends who were either in the Yachtsman's Reserve or wanted to join the Navy anyway, having to tell them to exercise patience until there was a billet for them. In the first 2.5 years of the war, we began to see the results of the huge shipbuilding program, with the corvettes beginning to come off the line and the minesweepers and the motor launches and some MTBs. Most of they were, of course, were shipped overseas. And the expansion of training facilities, this was always a tremendous never catch up business in those years, because Halifax now being the main naval port, it was rapidly flooded with people coming down either to join ships or to start training. And very quickly we expanded into all kinds of funny places, like the hockey rink became the signal school, and we took over the old military barracks from the army and started building temporary accommodation and temporary hospitals. These became quickly necessary as the first victims, particularly merchant seamen and our own people, began to come in as casualties from losses in the Atlantic. Another program, of course, was the conversion of the 3 Prince class CNR or XCNR triangle run passenger ships that were designed and built to run between Vancouver, Seattle, and Vancouver. They didn't do that very long because didn't pay, but they were 21 knot ships of about 7,000 tons, and it was decided to convert them into what we called auxiliary cruisers.
In 42, about you, when is that when you went to an operational posting?
Yeah, I finally got out of headquarters after a very interesting time, which, you know, saw the tragedies, and that was close to personnel, or close to everybody. Our first great loss, of course, in the war was the Fraser, and she was cut in two by the Calcutta after taking the remains of our army and diplomats out of France in a tragic time in May 40. And that was followed all too closely by the loss of Marguerite on the HMS Diana, which the Admiralty had turned over to Canada to replace the Fraser, On her first passage home, she was cut in two and sunk by a merchant ship in the convoy she was helping to protect. Those losses were doubly tragic because in both cases they were carrying, particularly Marguerite, was carrying some of the cream of the senior chief and petty officers in the RCM who were coming back either to be instructors in the rapidly expanding schools. They had been caught at the outbreak of war in the middle of senior technical courses in places like Whale Island and HMCS Vernon, and Marguerite was almost being used as a troop ship as well as her own complement to bring these men back. And we all lost a lot of great old friends and very, very fine men of the very finest caliber that I ever met in my life in that tragic, those two tragic sinkings. Well, in March of 42, I was finally, as I said, sprung from headquarters and was appointed as first lieutenant of the then building HMCS Iroquois, which was the lead ship of our four tribal class destroyer program, all of which were built by Vickers at their huge yard on Newcastle on Tyne. Quite rightly, before I went overseas, as the ship hadn't even commissioned, I was undergoing a short, intensive anti-submarine course in the AS school in Halifax when I received a signal from headquarters saying that my appointment had been changed and that I was to proceed forthwith with family to Esquimalt to take over as executive officer of HMCS Prince Henry. By this time in the war, the Prince Robert had been in commission longest of the three Prince boats, had been converted on the West Coast, spent all her time on the West Coast, had been responsible for the capture of one very fine modern German merchantman, the Laser, and the scuttling of two on the Peruvian coast, two others. And as the destroyers were all busy with their Atlantic duties, it was decided to send HMCS Prince Henry and David, who were converted on the East Coast, around to augment the patrolling of the West Coast. And this was done, and it was for this reason that when the Prince Henry arrived on the at Esquimalt, Lieutenant Commander Lieutenant Commander Wirtle was required to take over in HMCS Stadacona, and I was sent out there. These ships carried a war complement of approximately 450 men, but were, other than their physical presence, were really quite inadequate because they had old 6-inch guns of the turn of the century caliber from the secondary armament of old battleships, which had been stored around the world by the Admiralty against the arming of merchant ships. We looked very fearsome. We had a form of anti-submarine equipment, and so offensively we wouldn't have been a match for anything we might have come up against from the Japanese Navy. However, this was the better than nothing, and we patrolled off the Canadian coast from the Alaskan border to the border of Washington State for almost a year. Fortunately, I think for our sanity, this was the time of the terrible losses and height of the Guadalcanal campaign, and cruisers and destroyers were needed very badly by the USA in that area. At the outbreak of their war after Pearl Harbor, they had sent 3 heavy cruisers and 6 destroyers up to the Kodiak Dutch Harbor area to convoy and protect and be prepared to do battle with any Japanese naval forces, which after all had reached as far east as Attu and Adak, and had bombed in June of 1942, had bombed Dutch Harbor. So it was decided by the powers that be that the 3 Prince boats would take over from this very powerful force, and by doing so we relieved them, and they shoved off almost immediately for Honolulu and then down to the Guadalcanal area. This was a very interesting and worthwhile experience. In the end, we spent 3 months from September until the end of November convoying tankers and supply ships out from Kodiak to Dutch Harbor and back. And fortunately, I guess for all of us, we did not have any action of any kind. Years. Just towards the end of, in March 43, a very important and worthwhile decision was made to convert these 3 fine merchant ships into really useful naval vessels, and all these conversions were done in the North Yard in Vancouver. Prince Robert was converted to a very fine anti-aircraft light cruiser, and Prince Henry and Prince David were converted to landing craft ships, and as the war went on, they all did a very useful I stood by when we paid off, and my captain, Captain Edwards, went east to start the famous training establishment at HMCS Cornwallis near Digby in Nova Scotia. And so I was left with the 3 ships in refit at the yard in Vancouver for 3 months. And this again was also a very interesting and worthwhile experience for someone like myself. We had wonderful cooperation from the yard, particularly from the young naval architect who was responsible for the conversion of these 3 ships. About every other day, a whistle would blow, and you'd look around and another 10,000-ton Park ship would be sliding into the water, getting ready for joining the rapidly growing armada of merchant ships, which were carrying the sinews of war across from Halifax and New York and places like that to the battlegrounds of Europe. I left in June of 1942, when I turned over the Prince Robert to Captain Hope. These ships were commanded by captains in the RCN, and I went east again, much to my delight, on my way to go to sea on the Atlantic for the first time.
Okay, that's...
Can I have a question with that?